Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we have to step away from treating weight as a personal responsibility, because that kind of rhetoric puts a lot of shame on the individual, especially the fact that it's just simply incorrect. So even if it was something that was completely in control, it still would be stigmatizing and harmful to be doing. But it's even more ridiculous to be doing it when weight often isn't in somebody's control.
Hello, and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand our relationship with our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock, and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross, and I'm a writer. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest.
3, 2, 1.
Hi, hey, body protesters.
I said hey as well. I mean, I deviated.
Oh dear. Hi, honey. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, you know? I'm feeling alive. I'm feeling the summertime. I'm young. I'm in love. I'm thriving. What can I say? How are you?
All the better for seeing you.
God, feelings mutual.
So we have a jam-packed episode for you, so we're going to jump right in. But before we start, a very quick thank you for all the love on the first 2 episodes of the series. We're so glad that you're enjoying it as much as we've enjoyed making them.
It means so much to us because we have such a good time making this show.
Today we speak with Dr. Joshua Woolrich, an NHS surgeon, and we get really into it. So we speak about weight stigma, health at every size, Josh's own complicated relationship with his body and food growing up. And in honour of his new book, Food is Not Medicine, we got Josh to tell us how it is with some popular fad diets.
I think he's the first straight man we've ever had on our show. So that's a huge milestone for the Body Protest. We've never had a straight man on before, so it's very intriguing. And also, I think he's the first person we've ever had on who didn't have a long list of self-care. So that was also very interesting. We're learning something new every day on the job. But it was great to chat. And after the conversation, we have an amazing knowledge noodle on food insecurity and disordered eating from the mind of Dr. Nadia Craddock. We also signpost some fat activists, writers and scholars that you should know.
Okay, no time to leave. Let's hear from Josh.
Hello, my name is Dr. Joshua Woolrich, but that's my full title and only my mother calls me that. She doesn't call me that. I'm a surgical doctor within the NHS. I'm on a year out to do a master's degree in nutrition and public health. And I have a larger than I ever expected social media presence, talking mainly about weight stigma and what I coin as Nutribollocks. So people using spurious nutrition info to justify diets and all sorts of nonsense, which we may or may not get into. After originally setting up my social media profile as a weight loss account. Yay! So, yeah, that's me in a nutshell. And I make more enemies than friends, but hopefully I am doing more good than harm.
Thank you so much for joining us, Josh. We're so excited to have you on the podcast.
Right.
We like to kind of go in with this question and, you know, feel free to take it as deep as you like. But would you be happy telling me a bit about what your relationship with your body was like growing up?
Yeah. No, that's fine. It was complicated. As is probably the answer to pretty much anyone that ever has, if they're honest or slash if they have insight into what their relationship with their body and plus or minus food, because I think the two are nicely related, is. I think complicated is always the answer. And the sooner we get to realizing it's complicated, I think the better. But for me, the reason why is mainly, I think, because of the fact that I grew up in a house with an alcoholic father And that impacted my relationship with food first. From someone who is white middle class and went to private school, you wouldn't necessarily expect that I had elements of food insecurity as a kid, but I did because my dad would get drunk and not realize he'd fed us. So he thought he had, send us to bed. And as a 12-year-old kid, you can't argue against that. It doesn't work. So I would have to wait till my mum got home and then tell her we hadn't eaten, and then we'd get food late. So I decided I wasn't having any of that. And I would have a stash of food in my room to feel in control about the situation and not have it all left up to chance, because I couldn't predict when or how that would, what days that would happen on, for example. The only way of doing that as a 12-year-old was to steal, because I didn't have a job. And so I gained the habit of stealing tubs of Pringles from the local corner shop on the way home from school, and I would keep them in my room. And I would eat them. I would eat a whole tub if I was sent to my room to bed without food. And then I would have dinner as well when my mum got home. And for a 12, 13-year-old kid, that wasn't necessarily the most sensible option or healthy option, but that wasn't on my mind. My mind was control and trying to plaster over the fear and the kind of sadness and anxiety of the situation, because it's not fun, obviously, for someone of that age, for anyone.
Yeah, it sounds like you were kind of seeking comfort, control and comfort.
Yeah. Interestingly, because it became a routine, it also then became something I would do even if I did get dinner.
Yeah.
Because of that, plus other things, because weight is complicated. I grew up a larger kid than the average at my school. And so I got bullied for the vast majority of my school life for being fat. That, unsurprisingly, didn't make me magically lose weight. Mm. And so I went through medical school fat, starting to believe all of these things that I'd heard about myself and who I must be as a person because I was fat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So I started internalizing all of the weight stigma I'd encountered, including thoughts that I must be lazy, I must be this, I must be that. And ironically, if you think you're lazy, you kind of become more lazy. It's a weird one, that one. But you kind of lose the motivation to do something if you're like, well, people are calling me lazy anyway, so I might as well be lazy. It's weird. It's a strange double-edged sword. Mm. But yeah, left medical school believing I couldn't be a good doctor because I was fat, and went through very disordered methods of losing weight so that I could be a better doctor, which is very, very problematic. All stemming from experiences as a child of kind of not having security around food and growing up larger and being bullied and believing I wouldn't be loved if I was fat and all this kind of stuff. And it merged into believing I couldn't be good at my job if I was fat. So does that answer the question?
Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you. That can't have been easy to share. And we really appreciate that honesty.
I mean, it would be nice to be like, yes, I'm really bold with this stuff. But actually, I've come to a point, and I'm really glad I am at a point now where I can talk about this stuff. I wasn't for a long while.
Yeah.
But I also didn't understand it. And so it's very hard to talk about something you don't understand, because you don't know that that's what you should be saying to answer a certain question. So it's been a long road of working out my relationship with my father and things. And actually, intriguingly, after working through some of that stuff through many different ways, the stuff around food became more apparent. And it's been interesting learning about that kind of stuff, but really insightful as well.
It sounds like you've been on a real journey with everything in terms of your body, where you've been, where you're at now. You do talk a bit about how you were a weight loss account briefly.
Well, for a while, actually.
how long?
I would have started my account on Instagram January, because of course, January.
Classic, new year, new me.
Exactly. I would have started it January 2016, probably. Right. So 5 years. And the first like 2 or 3 years was just a weight loss account. But yeah, it started off as that because I decided that social media was the best way of keeping me accountable by leveraging shame, because of course it is.
Yes, shame always helps motivate. Apparently, I've heard that.
That's what I was told too. So I decided that I would just post everything I ate. And that way, if I post a picture of a biscuit, my friends would tell me off for posting a picture of a biscuit / eating a biscuit, and I would not eat any more biscuits. It wasn't good or healthy, but ironically it worked, because I just didn't eat any biscuits because I was too concerned about having to tell people, which was hot. Like, it's not, don't copy that. It's not
I good, really understand and empathize. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I did keto for 3 years, you know, which I'm not proud of. And I'm not ashamed of it, but it's so strange that you do, especially you fall into that trap on Instagram of you do post those things, and there is a thrill of being held accountable by your peers, and it's very toxic. Will you if you don't mind sharing, was there a kind of come to Jesus moment where you were like, maybe this isn't the answer? Maybe weight loss hasn't been the thing for me?
It was a gradual thing, because there was a lot to unpack about what I'd been taught and what I believed about myself and all sorts of things. But there definitely was a turning point, which I blame entirely on Laura Thomas, for what I perceived at the time for having a go at Halo Top ice cream soon after it arrived in the UK from the magical land of the US and low calorie ice creams, which I, at the time, being very much a dieting, weight loss, counting calories, was like, this is incredible. I was like, this is like, I'm gonna, why is it £5 a tub? This sucks. So yeah, I remember her posting something about, and it was actually really nuanced, and I think that was probably what drew me in, about why it wasn't necessarily all good and why there are definitely conversations to be had around the encouragement of binging, for example, because it directly encourages you to eat the entire tub in one go.
Yeah.
But it's okay because you're eating the low calorie version, rather than saying, well, why are we doing that in the first place?
Yeah.
And all sorts of other things that she was talking about. And I remember messaging her and going, you're wrong. And she, I don't know why I did that either, but she messaged me back and was nice. And then I was like, well, can I come and meet you then? Because I want to hear what you have to say.
I love that it was all kind of Laura Thomas and Halo Top ice cream that gave you this light, this epiphany.
Well, I mean, it's then a gradual step from then on.
Yeah.
Obviously, it wasn't an overnight thing.
No, of course.
And I left after an afternoon talking to her, which I never paid her for. I feel like I just took up all of her client time. So I left that afternoon with her sending me an email with a whole bunch of different papers to read and recommending that I check out Evelyn Tribbley and mm-hmm. the Intuitive Eating Book, and also to check out Health at Every Size, and just to kind of explore it, because from what she said, and I said to her at the time, I think I remember saying, well, that makes sense, but what if this? And I was doing the very standard stuff, the very like, yes, but what about the extremes? Yes, but what about this? Yeah, but does it actually contradict this? But what happens if it is, if you are unhealthy? And all this kind of natural, not necessarily correct, but predictable responses. She was very polite to me. and I started exploring some of it, and I realized that if I had any sort of integrity, and yes, that is a dig at some people who refuse to look at it after they hear about this stuff, because it is an integrity issue. If there is a risk that I am doing harm to my patients, I need to look at it properly. It doesn't matter whether that is a hard thing for me to do or not. That is a responsibility as a healthcare professional. And I think that's a responsibility as a human being as well. If you are, you know, if you are causing harm to others and somebody points out that that might be happening, the default position is not, it, or should not be, no, it's not, I refuse to even listen to you. They might be wrong, that's fine. Like, you're not always doing harm if someone's telling you you are, because some people are wrong. But to just point blank refuse to listen and to get your guard up, it's not about you at that point. It's not about you anymore. It's about the people that are coming to harm from what you're doing. And so I couldn't allow myself to ignore it without fully investigating it. And I didn't think I'd agree. Let's be clear. I thought I'd look at this stuff. I thought I'd look at Health Every Size and be like, well, that's very nice. I agree that we need to address stigma, but that's as far as I'm going to go.
Wow. So there was a part of you that wanted not to believe this.
Well, of course, because if I did, if I did believe it, it meant that I needed to apologize and to people that I had harmed, and I wasn't going to be able to do that because I don't have a record of every patient I've ever seen, and I knew that there were ways that I conducted myself in life and in my job that would have made me ashamed of what I'd done. And so of course I didn't want to admit that I might have been wrong. Nobody does. It became a gradual, like, 6 month change. Probably it took about 6 months to and documenting my changing thought process through Instagram as well, which was interesting. And the vast majority of people stayed as I continued. The last thing to change was my Instagram name, because I refused. No, I refused to tell you what it was.
Please,
I know. So did you?
Will you share it? No, it was
come
terrible.
Gone, do it.
Unfattening.
Yeah, yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Because I was unfattening. It was very
Josh.
Clever. It was very clever.
I just want to give that boy a hug. Like, I'm so sorry. But it you're here now.
I remember refusing to change it for a long while because mm-hmm. I liked the name and I thought it was clever. And I was like, it's attracting the kind of people I now want to speak to. And so I don't need to change it. It's blah, 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 blah. I had to get over myself.
So Josh, you've mentioned health at every size a couple of times there. I wonder for people who are unfamiliar with the term, if you could explain what it is and then maybe continue by sharing a little bit on how you navigate that approach from a medical standpoint.
Mm. HAES, or health at every size, it's essentially a challenge to practice healthcare in a different way. Healthcare, I would probably argue globally, is practiced with a very weight-centric approach, meaning that weight is commonly used as the kind of the determiner or the determining factor as to judge or assess someone's health. And it tends to be treated as the be-all and end-all of somebody's health and something that overweighs anything else that they do or might not be doing. And the main, I believe, the main goal and the main point of HAES, or Health at Every Size, is to change that from a weight-centric approach to a weight-inclusive approach. And that, I think that's the main point that people don't understand. A lot of people think, if I say that I work via a Health at Every Size way, they go, well, that means you don't believe weight can have any impact on health. I'm like, no, that's not the point, because that's not true. Mm-hmm. Because weight can have an impact on health. The vast majority of people aren't saying that it can't have an impact on health. We're saying that there's much more to that conversation. And so it's not about denying the impact of fat tissue possibly working as an endocrine organ, all that kind of stuff. It's not denying any of that. It's saying there is a lot more here that we need to talk about. We need to talk about the impact of weight stigma. We need to talk about the fact that it's never included in research in regards to, is it actually an independent risk factor when we're comparing body size and disease risk? We need to talk about the fact that when we start putting a focus on weight, we often ignore actual health promoting behaviors. And we know that weight loss is not a health promoting behavior. It's not a behavior, full stop. It's an outcome that may or may not occur. So there's a lot there, and there's a lot to discuss in regards to sustainability of weight loss because of the fact of deliberate weight loss, because of the fact that it is so complex as to the reasons why. So, for example, and I like using this as an example because it's very hard to disagree. As a kid myself, if you'd have put me on a diet at the doctor's at the age of 13 because I was suddenly larger than my peers, would the problems or the issues that I was experiencing as a kid have changed? No, none whatsoever. Nothing would have changed about the food insecurity. Nothing would have changed about my relationship with my father. Nothing would have changed about how I viewed myself as a person based on my size at that point. None of that would have changed. All that would have happened is you would have restricted my food and made me more insecure about what was going on. And that's the problem. That's the issue that isn't discussed, is that, or it's one of the issues anyway, is that weight loss and weight gain and the weight that people live at is incredibly complex. And so whether or not it's having an impact on health, if we refuse to acknowledge any of that, we're doing patients a disservice, and we are stigmatizing because we're treating weight as a personal responsibility. And we have to step away from treating weight as a personal responsibility, because it puts that kind of rhetoric puts a lot of shame on the individual, especially the fact that it's just simply incorrect. So even if it was something that was completely in control, it still would be stigmatizing and harmful to be doing. But it's even more ridiculous to be doing it when weight often isn't in somebody's control. That might be a challenging opinion for people to hear and believe. Mm-hmm. But I would advise you to delve into that. The treatment of body size as a personal responsibility, I think personally, is at the heart of the vast majority of the attitudes that we have towards patients, towards other people, other human beings. I think that if we could address that, a lot of good would be done and a lot would change. We've done it when it comes, well, we've half done it when it comes to poverty. Mm. You know, go back, I don't know how long, you can probably correct me, but let's say 20 years. And the vast majority of people would be of the vast majority of people not in poverty would be of the opinion that poverty is simply people not working hard enough, not saving enough. They just need to drag themselves out of poverty. Very American dream-esque.
I just think about the fact that had I heard you say that when I was a teenager who felt like a failure because I could not lose weight because it was not something that was in my control, I mean, it would have changed everything. And it's so lovely to hear you say that. I don't know, I think it's so important that these conversations are being had.
Yeah, and especially you being a doctor, being a surgeon from that point of view, I think that has so much more power and weight to it, for the want of a better word. And I guess relatedly, and you mentioned earlier that the medical profession has this very weight-centric approach traditionally, and I'm curious how we move healthcare professionals, both the medical field and public health, away from this myopic focus on weight and BMI, and how do we make healthcare more inclusive?
I don't know. if you know, please tell me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. There are mm-hmm. definitely things I think are helping, and I think being cognizant of what weight stigma is a really good start, because I was entirely ignorant of it. Even if you do still think that weight is a personal responsibility, if you start to understand how stigmatizing expressing that attitude to a patient can be, then even if we got people to pretend or hide, that's one start. It's not great, don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. it's a start. And actually, interestingly, I was having a conversation with a friend who's a medical student, currently a last year medical student at the moment this year. And she was saying that she doesn't remember at all in the last 5 years being taught about the social determinants of health. And that to me was quite surprising, because I'm not that old, but I left medical school about 6 years ago, and I don't remember it. But I thought perhaps I started medical school 12 years ago, so I don't know whether or not I remember everything that got discussed. But I thought, well, maybe the social determinants of health were discussed and I just don't remember or whatever. She has no memory of that being discussed either. And so I think that's a huge thing too. I think actually, if it's a course to teach people to become doctors who are stereotypically seen as kind of the center of healthcare, and you're not teaching them about how health is impacted by things completely out of somebody's control, then of course we're going to leave with an attitude of personal responsibility, not just when it comes mm-hmm. to weight, but personal responsibility when it comes to health. And especially if we believe that weight and health are intrinsically linked and are the same, then why would we not think that weight is a personal responsibility? I think those are two things that must be included in the curriculum. I'm still surprised that that's something that I had to learn after medical school rather than something right. I was taught from day one. That should be in the first mm-hmm. year to me.
Yeah, a big part of it, as you say, should be that education framing. And as you say, talking about weight stigma and all the consequences of weight stigma that we have, mm-hmm. and then social determinants of health, how that impacts people's weight and health separately and together yeah. and combined. And then the other thing I think for me that I think is really useful, especially from the science and the medic side, is the impact on yo-yo dieting and weight cycling. And we've got the government now saying, oh, everyone should lose 5 pounds and then, you know, we'll all be a bit healthier. And I was like, well, what's the backlash to that? What's the repercussion of doing that? If you're doing it in an unsustainable way and then you regain the weight and you go through this pattern of up, down, you're experiencing weight stigma, you've got some of these other social determinants of health impacting your daily life, the daily stressors. It's looking at all of those things and really being able to be more nuanced in your thinking and being able to critique the research and looking at correlational research and being able to see, okay, you've got BMI and you've got some kind of health outcome, but what are all the factors and mediating variables that are not included within that study, yeah. right? So I think especially from the medics and the public health professionals, like we're taught how to critique stuff, but I think there's like a blind spot when it comes to weight because we want to believe something that's so simplistic.
Oh, yeah. It's confirmational. I mean, I think that's something that has frustrated me over the last week as well. And I was saying to you briefly before we started that mm-hmm. because there have been some discussions in the public eye around weight and health in the last week, people have started coming out of the woodworks with their own not to beat around the bush, their own stigmatizing views on things. Mm. But what's interested me is that the same people who would call out, let's say, a single keto study for not changing the overall research, the overall body of literature that we have. So, for example, let's say we know that that a ketogenic diet is no different to one that contains carbs when it comes to weight loss. That is not just let's say, that's just true. Like, it doesn't make any difference whether you're eating keto or whether you're eating vegan with lots of carbs. It has no impact on sustainability or reliability or amount of weight loss. So we know that. And if we have a new study that comes out that says that keto is actually better, that doesn't change all of the research we have already straight away, right? It gets incorporated in the research and we look at it with a critical eye, but it doesn't change everything we have. The same people who are very up on that, very hot on all of that kind of stuff and understanding how this research works, are now the same people who are taking one single recent study about how exercise doesn't change the impact of BMI or mortality and going, see, we knew you can't be fat and fit. And it's like, hang on, are you forgetting how science works? Are you forgetting that this study only looked at three different conditions, one of which barely had any say in the entire paper? So two conditions. Mm-hmm. That's not the be all and end all of someone's health. There are lots of other things. Are you forgetting all of the other research we have that suggests that you can actually remove all mortality risk with cardiovascular health and with exercise, et cetera, irrelevant of weight? I mean, because yes, you are. You are ignoring all of that because this study fits your confirmation bias of what you want to believe and what you want to express. But you won't do that, and you'll call other people out about it when they do that about keto, but you're doing the same thing about this. I don't know why I can't remember now why I brought that up, but that's the stuff I'm seeing. And even though we understand, or people think they understand, this kind of research stuff, our confirmation bias of wanting to justify what we do on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and the attitudes that we have towards other people that are differently bodied to what we are, because if it's not a personal responsibility, then I'm not as self-righteous as I consider myself to be so amazing that I'm staying fit, right? I'm just doing so well, and I'm mm-hmm. such a blessing to the NHS because I'm doing my part. Fuck off. That's ridiculous. That confirmation bias encourages them to not have to consider that they might be wrong.
I feel like you are probably telling a lot of people to fuck off, or at least wanting to. What must it be like going against the grain in the way you are? Like, how do you
Stressful.
Manage? What keeps you motivated to keep kicking against the status quo?
The main thing is messages that I get. Mm. I don't know whether that's ironic or not, but it's just that is what encourages me to keep putting myself in situations where I feel like my resilience is being given a kicking. Mm. I am someone with a lot of privilege, and I want to use that privilege to put myself in situations that people without said privilege wouldn't be able to. Mm. You know, somebody in a larger body is going to be abused for their size when they speak out about this stuff. I don't get abused for my size. I get abused for other things. Mm. If I don't see any of the positives and all I see is the backlash, it's very hard. And I don't want to stop because I know that this stuff needs to be said. Mm. There aren't enough people saying it. Apart from coming across Dr. Lamry the other day, who is under the heading the Fat or Fat Doctor UK on Instagram, I don't know of anybody else who is outspoken and a medic in the UK. Mm. And that feels quite alone to be doing that. It's quite lonely. there just isn't any real support. There's support about obvious things, right? So if I post about somebody who ended up dying from cervical cancer that could have been treated because she was stigmatized for her size when she went in for a smear and never went back, I get overwhelming support from UK doctors, right? That's easy to lend support to. It's not hard, but it's not just the easy stuff that we need people to be sticking up for their patients for. We need them to be sticking up for their patients when it's difficult and when it means they might have done something wrong. And I don't see enough of that.
But it does sound like you're looking for accountability, which sounds very justified.
I mean, I don't see why not. I'm a patient too. Like, you know, if I go in and I've put weight on over lockdown, for example, if I need to go and see my GP or for something that is coming up, and all I get told is, well, you're heavier now than you were a year ago, so you should probably try losing weight because that will improve things. Mm. Why should I, you know, that we need people to be having conversations so that those kind of statements are only ever had if they are entirely relevant. And even when they are relevant, they are had with nuance and accountability and a way of discussing something that is a difficult topic and an understanding of the topic rather than just a blanket statement because it's a tick box on the GP records. Mm. Of course there should be accountability. This is not something that we can continue to sweep under the rug. I think we've got too far in terms of realizing that we can't continue to do this. And I think enough of the public are starting to realize that when they're stigmatized for their size at the doctors, they don't deserve it. Because take it back 10, 20 years and everybody would just say, oh yes, okay, no, you're right, doctor. And yeah. People would just accept it because it's normalized and it is the status quo. And now people and patients are starting to realize that actually what is being said is inappropriate. I think the backlash is getting more because it's becoming harder and harder and harder for people to ignore. And yeah. For people to continue practicing the same way.
Do you have any advice for listeners who might be facing weight stigma with their doctors?
Yes, but it's perhaps a little bit different to most advice that I see. The reason I say that is, and it's difficult, right? Because just to start off, I just want to say I don't agree that tone policing is a good thing. Mm. And by that, I mean, I don't believe you should have to water down or mince your words when you are subject to discrimination or abuse. I don't think you should have to. Mm. However, I know full well when I was of the opinion that weight was a personal responsibility and that weight and health are intrinsically linked and I should always tell my patients to lose weight if they were over a certain BMI, I know that if I had somebody come in to me, if I had a patient tell me or ask me, well, would you give that same advice to a thin person? I wouldn't have listened. I would have just gone, what? Like, that's no, of course not, because they're thin. I would have said something stupid and I wouldn't have understood. And so as much as that would have been a valid thing to say, logically, so is just turning around to the doctor and saying, you are being stigmatizing to me because of my weight. And even though that's valid, that doesn't necessarily achieve anything, because the purpose here, as much as we want to believe that healthcare is a relationship between patient and doctor, and it should be, and it is what we're taught, there is an undeniable level of hierarchy that we cannot get rid of because somebody is coming in at a disadvantage because they are worried about their health and they are coming in for help. So whenever somebody is coming to someone else for help, no matter how you structure the consultation or the conversation, or no matter how good a doctor might be at their communication skills, there is always going to be an element of hierarchical nature there that you cannot remove entirely. And so you're coming for help and you don't want to have to go and find some other doctor because not everybody has that ability either. The thing I would say is that there are two things that I think help. And one is the vast majority of people who are subject to weight stigma don't have a very good relationship with food. That's not necessarily the reason for their size, because again, as I said, it's very complex, the size that someone lives in. But being subject to weight stigma for that many years makes your relationship with food difficult because it makes you question everything you put into your body because you worry about your size all the time. And so describing the fact that if a doctor is trying to put you on a diet, even if it might have some relevance to your condition, talking to them about your relationship with food and saying that I'm concerned that this will be damaging to my mental health because I've dieted for years and years and years. And right now I would like you to give me some help for my ear infection. I don't want to have a conversation as much as I respect you. You don't have to respect them, but it's nice to say. as much as I respect you for the job that you do, please can we not talk about dieting right now because it's not helpful to me. I know that's not always the easiest thing to say and you don't want to be that polite, but I know that if I was told that by a patient, I wouldn't have been able to ignore that. Like, I'd be like, I don't understand what you're saying, but I can't tell you you're wrong because that's not okay. And those kind of conversations, I think, would really make a big difference, a really big impact. And the other thing I would say is just ask why. There's no problem asking. Make a doctor tell you why. If they're saying, well, you know, you go in with a condition and they say, well, I think you should lose weight, it'll help. And you say, well, can I ask why? Because a lot of the time they don't have a reason. And if you ask them why and they brush it off, you know that it's not actually relevant.
Yeah.
And they might be wrong in their reasoning afterwards as well. That's fine. But they might also be right. But you've asked why, and at least then there's a reason for them to have to justify what they're saying. And you can say, okay, well, thank you for explaining. Can you also tell me something else that will help?
Mm.
Like, that's fine. You don't have to necessarily say, I'm going to refuse to listen to you. But you can just say, well, can we talk about some other options too? Because a doctor should always give you more than one thing. This is a relationship. It's a patient-doctor conversation. It's not just, here is the only option, take it or leave it. I refuse to tell you anything else. That's not how it works.
Josh, I know you've got a book coming out, Food Is Not Medicine. I think it's available to pre-order,
am
I right?
It is, from all good bookstores, I think.
Excellent. So as a bit of a teaser for the book, I wondered if we could do a very quick fire round to get your medical opinion on some current diet trends.
Carry on, go. So, do I have to be polite?
No.
Let's go.
So I'm going to start. Opinions on a juice cleanse.
You can't cleanse your body. Why would you want to do it with juice anyway? You'll just wreck your teeth. Stop trying to think you can detox through food. It's not medicine. Can't do it. It's bullshit. Nonsense. Next.
Keto?
I mean, if you want to give yourself bowel cancer because you refuse to eat any fiber, and you also want to increase your risk of cardiovascular disease because no matter how well you do it, you are going to increase the amount of saturated fat you eat in your diet, go for it. If, however, you want to have a good relationship with food and also a nutritious diet, stop cutting carbs. Don't worry, you can't. Don't panic if you have done keto in the past, because just make sure you eat lots of fiber. Eat lots of fiber and have lots of nice, super healthy fats in your diet now, and you'll be fine. It doesn't wreck everything for the rest of your life, but why would you do it? Like, once you know those things, why? Why?
I mean, I just like bacon. I ate so much bacon at the time. but
well, exactly, right? And it's so easy, I know. Because bacon and butter sound like the perfect things to be having on a keto diet. And there's nothing wrong with them in isolation, but if that's making up a large percentage of your diet, that's a lot of saturated fat, and that's not good for you. It's just not.
There we go. Okay, next, gluten-free.
If you have celiac disease, great. If you have a gluten intolerance, fine. If you have the privilege of working with a dietitian or a nutritionist to figure out whether you actually have a gluten intolerance or whether you've just been avoiding gluten for so long because you thought it was bad for you and now it's difficult to eat gluten, that would be great too. They don't taste as good. Like, why are you buying the gluten-free stuff?
I know, if you don't need it, why are you doing that?
And it's more expensive.
And you're taking it away from people who actually need it.
I always think that gets me riled. Detox teas.
Again, same as the cleanse. You can't detox your body through food or drink. And the vast majority of them still contain laxatives. So why are you doing that?
Appetite suppressant.
Yeah, why? Why? If you're hungry, eat something. And it's not thirst, just to clarify. Everyone says, oh, it's so confusing between the two. Where is your source for that? Is it a dieting blog? Because yes, it's a dieting blog. There's no good source for that because it's not true. Your body's not stupid. If you were thirsty and you thought you were hungry, we wouldn't be still here. All an appetite suppressant is going to do is ruin temporarily your relationship with food because it's just going to blunt your hunger and it's disordered. It's not sensible or healthy or good. And you're just going to be hungry again afterwards. So you might as well eat then and eat something that is going to sustain you and fill that hunger rather than pretend it's not there and have an appetite suppressant lollipop or whatever they're selling nowadays.
Okay, what about alkaline diets?
Eat more veg, that's fine. It's got nothing to do with its pH though. It's just so it's just so ridiculous. The best way I can describe how ridiculous this is when you're severely unwell and people get admitted to places like ICU because they're so unwell, the pH of their blood is usually off whack, usually acidic. Because they're unwell and their body can no longer manage it. Your body can manage it unless you're severely unwell, just to clarify. Again, if we couldn't, we wouldn't still be here. Now, if an alkaline diet or food or veg or a juice cleanse, which claims to be good because it's alkaline as well, if any of those could fix it, we would be using them in ICU because it'd be much cheaper than the medication we have to use to sort out someone's pH. I think that one pisses me off the most because it's used to argue for cancer treatment.
Yeah.
That one kills people. And so I think that one is like a juice cleanse, it damages your relationship with food and probably doesn't make you feel very good. An alkaline diet actually kills people because it's sold as a cure for cancer. Mm. And so, that one gets me riled up, and I think validly so.
No, I think that's important. My last one, intermittent fasting.
Mm. Oh. Privileged starvation, you mean? Sorry, you misspoke, right? that's what you actually meant to call it, because it is. There are lots of people in this world who have a lot of food insecurity and don't have the privilege of choice to refuse to eat. It is something that they struggle with. It is starvation and it is privileged. If you have the ability to refuse to eat food and only eat in a certain window of time, not only is it ridiculous because it doesn't have any benefit to you unless you like eating that way, and then that's fine. But it's privileged starvation. You can argue with me all you like, but it's the same thing.
And both me and Nadia are like completely in agreement, not going to argue. No.
I more meant the listener.
I've never heard anyone put it phrase it like that, privileged starvation. I really like that.
Yeah, it's one of the subheadings in the book, intermittent fasting or privileged starvation. I quite like that subheading.
I like that. Very good. We love to end the podcast with this question because we feel like it ties it up nicely. It's a bit cozy. What are things you do to look after yourself, to make yourself feel better, especially after you've been like going against the grain and fighting the good fight? What do you do for yourself?
I need to be better at doing stuff for myself.
Ooh.
Let's put it that way. I don't really have an instant answer to that, and I probably should. There are a few things that I like doing that I used as a justification to kind of switch off, if you know what I mean. So like watching YouTube or playing chess on my phone or stuff like that, but it's like passive switching off rather than active switching off. I think I need to get better at doing that because it is stressful. Life is stressful for everyone, whether or not you're fighting weight stigma on the internet or not. We need to have some ways of building resilience. And I think I've relied on my natural resilience, which is unearned, for a bit too long. Because I do have a lot of natural resilience for some reason. And so I've always used that as an excuse not to need to find other mechanisms to reset, I guess. Yeah, resilience doesn't last forever.
No, and also just because you can withstand something doesn't mean you should have to. Yeah. Just because you are strong doesn't mean you have to keep on weathering that.
Yeah.
Find those ways to fill up the cup.
Exactly.
Rather than just look the other way whilst the cup is still half full. Be like, it's fine. Yeah. I'm playing chess now.
Be okay.
I'll come back to it later. Maybe it'll have rained. Who knows?
Josh, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. As we sign off, where can we find your work and how can we, Honey and I, and our listeners support you and your work?
Social media is the easiest place to find me. I spend too long on there, but mostly on Instagram, Dr. Joshua Walrich, DR, rather than spell it all out. It's too long otherwise. I'm also on Facebook. If you're over 40, then Facebook is great. No, I'm teasing. And I'm on TikTok. Woo! If you're a child. Seriously, I feel so old on TikTok. Even though I'm not, I'm only 30. It's not that, I'm not that old, but yeah.
No, but it makes me feel old. They're all so youthful and dancing. Why is everybody dancing?
Exactly. Firstly, I can't dance. Secondly, like there are people there who've never seen Bambi. I just don't.
That's
like,
stressful.
I know.
I didn't need to hear that today.
So I'm all of those things. And I do have a book coming out, which was mentioned a bit earlier, which I would love you to buy. The reason why I want you to read the book is because I am actually really proud of it. It's allowed me to talk about things in much more detail than I have been able to on social media. And one of the frustrating aspects of social media is that it's very hard to get across adequate nuance about topics because you're so limited to what you can say. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy for you to come across in the wrong way when you're trying to describe something because people won't watch everything you say. And if they only hear half of it, they may come away with a different opinion to what you actually mean. Mm. So that's one of the most frustrating aspects of social media to me. And I love the fact that I've mm-hmm. been able to put some of that into a book. So yeah, it's not just about food. The whole first half is about weight and health and people's relationship with food and my backstory and disordered eating and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the second half is about Nutribullocks and stuff, but there's a clear link between the two. So go and read my book and then tell me if you liked it. That would be what you can do for me because I think it's cool.
I feel like we so rarely hear about food insecurity in the context of complicated relationships with food, but it makes so much sense. What does the research say?
Okay, well, first of all, you're so right. We don't hear about food insecurity and complicated relationships with food very often. But let's define food insecurity first. I love a definition. Food insecurity is something we often call or term a social determinant of health. And specifically, food insecurity is when a household has insufficient access to nutritious food due to low resources. So unsurprisingly, we see greater food insecurity among low-income households. But what I thought was really interesting was Josh's example is that it's not limited to low-income households.
So can we dig into the research a bit more then?
Yeah, so as you say, there's not much out there, but very helpfully, there was a review paper published last year led by someone called Dr. Vivian Hazard, which very helpfully, as I said, sums up the current evidence. And I'll pop a link to the paper in the Google Drive. Essentially, bottom line is that there's a clear trend between food insecurity and disordered eating, and perhaps particularly disordered eating in line with bulimic symptoms, so binging and compensatory behaviour like vomiting or laxative abuse.
Why do you think that is?
So, and this is definitely not me, this is taken directly from the review paper, but one of the reasons that they've put forward is that a lot of people living with food insecurity experience, quote, feast or famine cycle, where there's either food is abundant or it's not, and it's limited. So it kind of artificially creates a binge restrict cycle, regardless of whether it's a dieting thing or not.
It's so interesting because it literally is insecurity. Like, it's a lack of security when it comes to knowing when your next meal is coming around that, in terms of the feast or famine concept.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, your body doesn't know what's happening. And then there's this really classic study from the 1940s, it's the Minnesota starvation experiment, where they were looking at the effects of starvation, essentially, and they had healthy volunteers, so people who were deemed like physically and mentally healthy at baseline, and then they kind of imposed semi-starvation. I can't remember the calorie numbers, but I don't think that that's important. But what they found as a consequence to that starvation period is that when food was available again, people started binging, because that is your body's like natural response of like, there has been food scarcity, therefore I will binge. We talk about that with dieting quite a lot, in terms of people restrict their food intake and then your body's like response is like, well, I need to eat.
It calls out for nourishment. Yeah. And it's often an uncontrollable urge, I imagine. That's so interesting.
Yeah, so essentially what the research says, and there's more to be done for sure on this topic, but people who live with food insecurity are at higher risk of disordered eating behaviours, and it's something that often gets overlooked in the research. So a big thank you to Vivian for writing that review paper. We see people with more severe food insecurity are more likely to engage in those compensatory behaviours as well, so as well as the binging, but also the vomiting or the laxatives or whatever. So
it's so interesting because, again, this seems to go against the stereotypes that we are often taught about eating disorders, in terms of like, obviously we were said it's not all low-income houses that have food insecurity, but it's interesting to note that that again goes directly against the stereotypes that we have discussed on previous episodes.
Yeah, and then it but also makes complete sense when you think about it, because of how our bodies respond when there's not much food.
Completely.
And also, like, if you also just think about it in terms of when there isn't much food, what happens? It's not just a physical response, a biological response. It's also, there's definitely that, but then there's also the cognitive emotional response where you're, and anyone who's ever dieted will know this, like when you're dieting, you are thinking about food
all the time.
Yeah, it's all you think about.
So it's like increased preoccupation with food, it's increased anxiety, you're just generally more likely to binge. So
gosh, there we go. That's fascinating. Thank you so much for that delicious noodle, Nadia. I'm stuffed.
I just laugh every time about this noodle thing because I've told you this before, but my family nickname is Noodle.
Knowledge Noodles. Noodles, Nadia. Nadia Noodles. It's all happening.
So before we sign off, as promised, we want to signpost to some of our favourite fat activists and scholars who we learn so much from. It's not an exhaustive list by any stretch, but a really good starting point, we think. So first of all, we have Aubrey Gordon, aka Your Fat Friend, who often writes anonymously on topics related to health, weight stigma and fatness. Then there's Monica Creti, whose work often focuses on medical weight stigma, who I actually met at Harvard Striped, so through our previous week's guest, Professor Bryn Austin. Then there's Mikey Mercedes, a PhD student at Brown, whose work I came across via Monica. So a lot of interconnection there. Then there's Sophie Hagen, Danish comedian, writer and podcaster.
And also, I can't forget to mention, you can go back into the Body Protest archives and listen to our episode with Philippa Deirdrix and also Virgie Tovar more recently.
Of course, we can't forget the people that we have spoken to on this very podcast. Okay, honey, I think we're done. I love you.
Oh, I love you.
Thank you for listening to The Body Protest.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode, and it would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is produced and edited by the glorious Daisy Grant.
And it's brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.